The following podcast is sponsored by SuperheroStuff.com.
So I'm putting some dishes away.
Yeah.
I'm at the cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, there's an antique cookie jar sitting on the shelf.
Is this story going to end poorly for the cookie jar?
Yeah, I don't know. So I don't know what possessed me to think about it. I was like, I should put something in that cookie jar because I never put anything
cookies,
in the cookie
maybe?
Jar. So I open it up, and there's Halloween candy in there from who knows when. None of it's dated. And I'm looking at it. Oh, it's Halloween candy. But the layer of dust that's on the top of the cookie jar clearly indicates it's been there. I mean, it's been there at least a couple of years that it's been, because that's where that cookie jar, I moved whenever, I got divorced and rearranged the house and all that.
Sure.
That's where it ended up. I was like, how long has this stuff been in here? it's one of those things that just kind of starts to creep you out a little bit because you're like, oh, maybe I should clean up around here sometime. I don't know. Greetings, everyone. Welcome to this episode of H2O. Jason Hunt here along with Timothy Harvey.
Hello.
And we are telling stories tonight, talking about story. And yes, we'll just acknowledge right up front that there is these goings on with the Hugo Awards. That's all over the internet right now, and at some point in the near-ish future, we will address it. We'll discuss it. I imagine we'll probably take a turn on it on Echo Chamber as well.
Yeah.
But we want to do our homework first. We want to make sure that our understanding of the circumstances is clear enough that we can be objective
as much as possible. And I think that's something that if you've listened to us, I think Jason and I try really hard to be as objective as possible. Now, doesn't say that we don't have opinions, we don't have strong opinions, or we don't disagree with each other. You've heard us disagree on this program if you listen to us
a little bit.
But this is a sticky thing. This is a rabbit hole. Kind of dark, ugly,
and it's very
thing
it's
right now.
Very quickly going sideways.
I think it was doomed from sideways.
I think it was. But we are going to be looking at it. We are going to be discussing it at a future point. Because really, I mean, not only does it behoove us to talk about it just in the general sense of addressing the ideas and whatever the context and that. But we also have to consider the fact that Worldcon is going to be here next year. We are going to be at ground zero for the Hugos next year. And
we're not going to be able to avoid it because it's going to be whatever happens in between then and now is going to have an impact on... I mean, if this thing blows up and turns into... I mean, it's already blowing up.
Yeah.
But if it gets turned into something much, much nastier, then we're already getting a lot of nastiness hitting out. But if it gets much, much nastier, it's going to be playing out in some fashion in front of us. And
we will be there.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Live. We will cover everything.
And I think that's going to be... And I think that we owe it to you to give you as much context... For good and for ill, and I think
on both sides.
And right now, I mean, just on an emotional level, I think we would have a hard time talking about this in fairness to all the parties, because it's the initial layer of things. It's kind of like talking.
Yeah, we've got to dig down pretty deep and go back, because I think this goes back. And I've seen this mentioned several times. This goes back even further than last year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
This goes back years and years.
Well, and there was a question about John Scalzi's stuff back when he was running it. And I think that, but I think that, and that has more than one side to it, too. So I think that you can definitely, I think this is something that built on a lot of different things, and it came from other places from outside. Some of it came out from outside the Hugos entirely.
Yeah.
This is not some of what we're hearing is basically saying the Hugos is just the latest battleground for something else that, and again, without turning this into the thing we don't want to talk about tonight, because we talked, when this blew up, Jason and I sat down and we're like, do we want to talk about this? And I'm like, well, I just read this. And Jason's like, well, I just read this. And we're both kind of going, this is not, I don't know if we want to. And we had a conversation late last night. So we're recording this on a Tuesday. This is Monday. Wow. This week is already clipping along. A lot of times we're doing this on a Tuesday. But I called him last night and I was just like, I'm actually angry right now.
Yeah.
And I was just like, you know, it's not a place I got a real slow burn on being angry.
Mm-hmm.
There are people, I've lived in Kansas City since 2005, and there are many, many friends of mine who have never seen me lose my temper. And I was mad. Yeah. And I'm like, Jason, I'm really angry.
I can hear it in your voice. I've never seen you blow up. I've never seen you lose your temper, but I have been on the fringe of a couple of those type things. But yeah, I think I definitely think that there is more to it than what we've scratched the surface.
Right, and if I'm gonna have that kind of emotional response to what I've read so far, then I think that it in the sense of what we try and do here, which is give you guys a fairly reasoned argument for whatever we're talking about.
Yeah,
I don't want to be coming at it from.
You don't want to be that guy.
I don't want to be because unfortunately, and we've talked about this before, the internet is a great place to go be angry.
Yeah.
And there's some real drawbacks to that. And I can guarantee you that if we were to pull all of these people who are very publicly tearing at each other right now off the internet, and well, first of all, we'd figure out there's a hell of a lot less of them. Because the internet always magnifies you.
I don't know that I even want to entertain this notion at the moment, but I'm tempted to see if any of them on either side
would sit down and do
an echo chamber with them.
The only way that I would say that if we did that was if we just can't do it live. I mean, we can't air it live.
It's got to be
the kind of thing where it's just like, you know,
it'll be moderated.
Oh God. There's part of me says yes, and part of me goes, oh God, no. So anyway, we'll talk about this another time because, like I said, we could turn the entire night easily into talking about this, and again, we come back to the fact that we need to be better served in terms of our context. Because like I said, I was mad, and if I'm, and you know what, we may get into the context and I may still be mad, but at least I want to feel like I need more depth and more breadth before I can sit there and go, you know what, folks, this is me being mad and this is why. And as opposed to just an initial emotional reaction.
Yep.
So
that's in the plans later. Tonight we're going to talk about something that we have touched on and we have hinted at for a number of episodes. We kick around this idea on a number of podcasts, not just here on H2O, but we do address it as well on Level 1187 when we're talking about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Agent Carter. This idea of story.
Yeah.
The idea that story should come first as opposed to the action sets or the stunts or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to talk tonight a little bit about what makes a good story. Tim?
Well, the answer is, you know what? There's a couple of things that make a good story. Actually, there's more than a couple. And you can find, you know, it's not about writing style. Isaac Asimov, if you go back and you read his stuff, you often realize he's incredibly dry.
Yeah.
If you read Ray Bradbury, you find somebody who's very, his prose is very lyrical. It's very dreamlike in places. It's got a very much a, almost a, Well, he was. I mean, he in many ways he was a storyteller first. I mean, his stuff has a very story. I'm telling you a story. Yes. Kind of quality. And you look at somebody like, let's go modern. Let's go or very modern. Let's go Neil Gaiman. Okay. There's a certain fairy tale quality to a lot of what he writes as well. Usually, it's something you know, a darker flavor of fairy tale.
And then you get somebody like David Weber.
Oh yeah,
who's very straightforward. Mm-hmm. Very you
or
know,
John Ringo you know,
John
or
John Ringo or Peter David.
Mm-hmm.
Now Peter David has fun with his stuff because he does, especially in the tie-in stuff. He'll have more in the way of winks at the audience.
Sure.
With his he's got the Easter egg that he does every now and then. But for the most part, his stories are pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
They're fun.
Yep.
You know, Kevin J. Anderson is another one where
Jasper Ford or
I really liked reading Anne Crispin's stuff.
Oh yeah.
Or Anne McCaffrey, you know, any of those. Well, Anne McCaffrey has the advantage with the Dragon Riders. It's interesting to see because now that Todd's writing the books, you can definitely tell it's not Anne writing the books.
Right.
But it's close enough because, you know, it's Todd. He's done it, you know he's her son and he's done it with her, a number of times and now he's doing it. Same with Brian Herbert over with the Dune books.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely going to notice a different tone too. I mean, because Frank Herbert had a distinct, especially with the Dune books, had a distinct style to that storytelling. It's hard to reproduce, and in some cases, especially real quickly about legacy authors, folks who are carrying on the story when the original author either ended the series or died. Or I mean, I think that you run a real risk in doing a pastiche.
Oh yeah.
And I think that sometimes it, sometimes if you're, you know, okay, well, a Sherlock Holmes story, all right, in fact, in many ways, that's kind of the king of the pastiche story anyway, right?
Yeah, because everybody's got to do it the same kind of
way. And there's kind of a tradition to that, and in some respects, but it's built in. But if you're getting stuff, all of this genre stuff, I think that it would run a risk. You're not going to be able to. It's going to be very, very hard to get the tone and voice of Frank Herbert or J.R.R. Tolkien or Anne McCaffrey or Asimov or Clark or any of these guys. You're not going to quite. You're not them,
right?
You know, so you can come close, and I think that you run the. Was it Ian Colfer who wrote the last Hitchhiker's book?
Yes.
He doesn't really go after a Douglas Adams tone.
No, and I remember reading some interviews where he said he deliberately avoided doing that because he didn't want to get sucked into doing a pastiche.
Well, and I think that
and
you
get
would,
called out on it.
Well,
because
I think it would be
wrong.
It'd be hard pressed to do. It's so it's like when we did the Terry Pratchett episode.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if the books continue in some form with a new author, whether it's his daughter or another author that she handpicks, it's going to be really, really hard to get Terry's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that whoever that author is probably going to sit there and go, I'm not even going to try. I might try and get the voices of the characters
right
because that's important. But in terms of the voice of the narrator that was never really, it wasn't actually a narrator so much, but Terry's voice was all, those books were almost meant to be read out loud.
I remember when I wrote, you talk about getting the character voices.
Mm-hmm.
I did a short story as an entry into the Star Trek Strange New Worlds thing. And in my various attempts to write Star Trek fiction, submitted scripts to the shows when they were taking open, open submissions.
Yeah.
One of the big things that was important to me was making sure that the characters sounded like the characters.
Right.
And I would listen to, whatever dialogue that I'd written, I'd play it in my head and see, okay, does that fit?
You know,
the cadence and the nuance of the use of language, the type of words that are used and that kind of thing. And you're right, it is a challenge, especially if you have, if you're trying to match or you're trying to emulate or at least get in the same ballpark as somebody who's got such an established stamp
mm-hmm.
on a set of stories. I remember when I was reading Dune, I was about halfway through it and realized that Herbert was using water phraseology mm-hmm. to describe the desert. Mm-hmm. Everything with the sand is it was a brilliant device, and I didn't even pick up on it until I picked up on it.
Sure.
And then I saw it mm-hmm. and it was like I would probably never have thought to do it that way.
Well, I think that especially when you get into something like, I mean, the people who are hired to be writers in the Star Trek series or in the Star Wars series of books.
I would love to be one of those.
One of the reasons that they're successful when they're successful, and the ones you can tell who really aren't quite as successful as they ought to be, is when they capture that voice. And yeah. it's almost a requirement. I think it's got to be a requirement that you can actually, because we come from, we're talking about characters who are established. There's a voice. Everyone knows what Jim Kirk sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Even to the level of parody. But everybody knows what Spock sounds like and McCoy sounds like and things like that. And so if you can't reach that point, if you can't get that vibe,
mm-hmm.
that tone, then it's not, the book's not going to read properly. And it's kind of like on a Star Wars book, even though we've only had, well, back in the day.
Vonda McIntyre wrote a Star Wars book.
Yeah.
The Crystal Star.
Yeah, Crystal Star.
Terrible Star Wars book.
It was not a good Star Wars book.
Terrible Star Wars mm-hmm. book. Now, Vonda McIntyre is a good writer.
Yeah.
She's an award-winning science fiction sure. writer of, mm-hmm. of many, many, many moons. But that book was so completely off base
yeah.
in terms of the characterizations of these, all of these characters that we've known for 30 some odd years. Well, wait a minute. They wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Now, he wouldn't say that. Now, they wouldn't act like that. What? Well, has she not seen Star Wars?
Well, that actually takes me back to one of the things that is important with story, which is internal consistency. And for something like that, you're looking at, it has to be consistent with the established world that it exists in. But if whether it's a TV show or a movie or a novel or a comic book or a video game, because video games are very story based now, you have to have internal consistency.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, your character, if your character is established as this and halfway through the book it becomes that, then you better have a reason. I was interesting that IO9 did a list of fantasy novels recently. I think they were talking like Game of Thrones-ish kind of stuff, right? And they mentioned the Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, which is Stephen Donaldson.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep.
I'm a huge fan. It is not an easy series to read because pretty much right off the bat, you establish that your hero is kind of a monster. But he puts him on quote unquote a hero's arc, and then manages to derail the arc over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And by the time you're done, you're more invested in the character because all the consequences of his actions never go away.
Sounds like the beginnings of an article there, Tim.
Could be, especially since the series just finished. He just published the last book in the series.
Well, there you go.
But it's the kind
I
of
expected on my desk on Friday.
Oh, good luck with that. but the thing is that you end up with he very much took the tact, and it's the kind of world building that's Tolkien level. All right.
Yeah.
But it's also the kind of that current crop of fantasy, and the series is like 20 years old, more than that now, I guess. Goodness, yeah, more than that. But it's the kind of thing you see a lot now, which is the ordinary person from our world ends up in the fantasy world has to deal. But it's internal consistency is very important, and if you're going to put your character through hell, make sure there's a reason for it. But also know who your characters are
before you start.
Well, okay. Well, you can argue that a lot of authors will say they're discovering the character as they're writing. I think that's very true because in some of the scripts I've written, the character as I started writing the script became something else by the time I was done.
But I've seen also where authors will sit there and say that once they have the characters pretty solid in their heads,
mm-hmm.
when they start writing it, you know, that whole. The story just kind of wrote itself because you internalize these characters so much
mm-hmm.
that you know how they're going to react to certain circumstances you set out there in front of them. So it's almost like you need to have your world building done to a certain extent at least before you ever start actually going into crafting your story. You could have it plotted out. You could have the outline.
Well, you need to know where you're putting your characters. Yeah. And you have to know the context they're operating. Because I think that a good story involves characters that you care about. A good story involves a series of events that are interesting. A good story involves a resolution that is satisfying. Even if it's not a happy ending.
And there has to be internal logic that makes sense.
An internal logic. You have to hold consistency. Now
for those of you listening, I want to make a note here right now, because this will play into our later discussion. Mm-hmm. Not once in there did you hear Mr. Harvey or I ever mention that the beliefs and politics and the overview and the internal combustion engine that drives the author himself makes for a good story. It's not about what the creator of the story thinks. It's about what's in the story.
Right. Because I think, and I've said this before.
Just to be clear.
You can disagree with the author's politics or belief and still enjoy their story.
Yeah, but that's at the crux of what's going on with the Hugo.
Sure, but I mean, at the same time, I think that, you know, okay.
I'm planting seeds.
I see that, yeah. But and let me plant another one here. Tom Clancy, not a genre author.
No.
Well, he is not this genre. Yeah. You know, spy thriller, techno thriller. Really, I don't agree. He's much more conservative than I am. Loved his books.
Mm-hmm.
Until they became the collaboration books, which was, it's like, okay, these are just, I mean, I kind of felt that was, but unfortunately, that's the thing with a lot of authors. Pick, you know, not every author is a good collaboration author.
Yeah.
And I think that you lose something when, but anyway, the Jack Ryan.
Did you read the theory that he'd been killed by the CIA?
No, but it fits in the context of. You know, I think it's unlikely.
there's a theory floating around the internet right now that he was a target of the current administration, just as Andrew Breitbart was, because they were getting
I'm gonna call shenanigans on that one.
The theory's out there.
Well,
there's
lots of theories out there about a lot of things.
It's context.
But anyway, Clancy, you know, I enjoyed his books immensely, except for the fact that after a while it was like it was a technical program.
Yep.
You know, and toward the end, I was skipping chapters. I was just, get me back to the story. I don't care about the tech. The tech specs are interesting for a while, and then I lose interest. Or Orson Scott Card, I don't agree with what the man believes. But at the same time, I will champion Ender's Game and the first few books of the Alvin Maker series as being solid, I mean, just good stories.
Mm-hmm.
So you do that. You have to look at some of these books. Frank Miller. I think Frank Miller's crazy. I think the man lost his mind a long time ago. But you cannot tell me that the Daredevil run that he's famous for, or the first Dark Knight, you know, the Dark Knight Returns, or some of the stuff he did in the 70s and 80s,
yeah,
and a lot of the Sin City stuff is not just fantastic storytelling.
Well, on the flip side of that, you've got somebody like David Gerrold.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I've read some of the different things that he's posted on Facebook and some various different places on his blog, and mm-hmm. I have absolutely nothing in common with this man,
right?
Other than the fact that we both love science fiction, mm-hmm. and he frequently will go back to the importance of a story, in terms of whatever it is that you're reading or you're writing or watching or anything like that. And you're right; it is, you know, 'cause I can watch The Trouble with Tribbles, and sure. I can read the Galactic Whirlpool,
mm-hmm.
and it's good Star Trek.
Yep.
And I don't think anything about it.
Right. And I think
who wrote it.
And this is not to say you can't have a good science fiction story that's about politics or religion, or these are
you within
know,
the context
within
of
the context
story.
Of the story. I think that you run the risk, and I'm not going to say you can't do this because you can. It's a balancing act because I would assume that as a writer you want the largest audience possible.
This
may be an incorrect assumption.
You'd think.
But so at the same time, a lot of times turning something into a personal, this is my personal thing out there. I'm not saying you can't do it or you can't do a good story at it. I'm saying that you may end up finding yourself with a much more narrow audience.
Yeah. Now, David Weber does a really good job of balancing all of that out because, you know, he is not a liberal.
Right.
He's more, you know, conservative mm-hmm. libertarian. And I asked him about it one time about, you know, because he has some people accusing him, I guess you could say is the word, of being a conservative. How dare he be that way? Because of a lot of the things that are going on in the characters in his books. And he told me that one of the things that he's made a big effort to do is make sure that the politics in the story are the politics of the characters.
Right.
And you do have a really good mix. You have people who believe that the government is the end-all, be-all answer to everything, and you've got the people that think the military is a bunch of, you know, jackbooted thugs. You've got that whole range of, of beliefs in mm-hmm. there. And I would be hard-pressed to pick one character that represents Weber's view, because I don't know Weber's view. And that's the way it should be.
Sure.
Because, I'm going to be reading the story of Honor Harrington and all of that universe. I'm not going to be reading a story about David Weber's universe.
Right. And honestly, if David Weber wants to write a book where he puts out his political views, I'm more likely to read it than because of what he's written before, mm-hmm. He's already established himself. Now, I'm not saying this is necessarily something I want, because I would much rather just read the story.
Yeah.
You know, There are many, many places I can go to get my politics,
all of the commentary that goes with it.
Right, and sometimes a good political science fiction novel, they're out there.
Mm-hmm.
A good political. It's hard to have a political horror novel.
Mm.
Probably because I think that you have, for really good horror, you almost have to step outside reality to a point enough. Even with a slasher story, with just a straight serial killer, you almost have to. Politics becomes the incidental.
There's kind of a political component in Aliens.
Well, yes, there
a
is.
Little bit. Corporate politics.
Well, corporate politics, and of course, that was an interesting thing because one of the things that happens with storytelling, especially in movies, is there are trends. Right, so you look at when did Blade Runner come out? When did Aliens come out? When you look at this stuff, where the view of the corporations growing to take over the world, and they were so naive.
Well, no, and I
they thought it was going to be international corporations taking over the world. They had no idea that Facebook and Google were going to come along. Bow down before your masters.
funny you should mention that. I got an email.
Says the guy who's got Facebook open on his laptop.
I got this email today from Sci-Fi.
Yeah.
This is from the publicity department, those that have not blocked us on Twitter.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Sci-Fi has greenlit a new pilot from Matt Damon and Ben
Affleck. I saw that, yeah. Uh-huh.
It's called Incorporated.
Right, and to me it actually feels a little it feels a little bit like, just by the blurb there, it feels a little bit like almost that 80s, early 90s kind of the corporations rule the world and we must fight against
their... Well, that was the setup for Continuum.
Yeah, it was.
You know, the corporate oligarchies that have been taking over the thing. But the blurb here, for those of you who have not heard about this yet, set in a future, I'm quoting now from the press release, set in a future where companies have unlimited power, Incorporated tells the story of executive Ben Larson forced to change his identity in order to infiltrate a cutthroat corporate world to save the woman he loves.
So it's said,
in the process, he will take on the entire system with deadly consequences.
So it's set in 2015, then. So, well,
it's being billed as a futuristic espionage thriller.
Yeah, and I think
what was that one that Damon did? The guys with the hats.
Adjustment Bureau.
The Adjustment Bureau.
I kind of like that movie. It's not a great movie, but it was. I enjoyed it for what it was, which is.
But this goes back to. And it's funny because I don't want to diverge into this area here. But Larry Correa was talking because on all of this whole Hugo discussion, one of the things he said that you can find in this is his view that you can talk in the Hollywood and the publishing industry right now. Leaning left, you see that reflected in a lot of the stories. And now here's this, the evil corporation. And this is something that we see over and over again in Hollywood. It's not just something that's,
well,
that's
but
and
that's
it's not,
not
new.
New. I mean, that's not even.
But how long has Hollywood had?
Well, but it's not just Hollywood. You look at a lot of this stuff. I think the part of the problem is that we, and I think a lot of this came out of. I think a lot of this really did come out of that period in the 80s where corporations were starting
to get... The decade of greed.
Well, corporations were starting to get a lot of power, and we started to look, and there was a time when we were really concerned about Japan's growth, and nobody really realizing that Japan's economy was about to tank. Yeah. And
you remember that comment in Back to the Future 2? Oh, no wonder the circuit failed. Look at it. It says made in Japan.
Right.
What are you talking about, Doc? All the best stuff was made in Japan.
Yeah. But so you get things with like Blade Runner where you have that mix of Japanese influence is huge there because the Japanese in the context of that world have become very influential in America.
Nobody was looking at China.
Nobody was looking at China. But even then, I mean, what China, the problem is that writing a good science fiction novel about China right now is that you have to spend a lot of time talking about trade agreements and discount. And this is not knocking China.
Wait, that sounds familiar.
Hang on.
Hold on.
It didn't work out well. Let's not go there. But that's just it. You can write. Dune is an example. There's a lot of politics and economics,
That's all that is.
I know,
really.
And the thing is
religious prophecies.
Oh, sure. And
religion.
And what he did was he took Eastern religion and he took economic theory. And he took oil. He basically, a lot of it, because the spice is very much an analogy for oil, an analog for oil. And he looked at Catholicism, and he looked at a lot of different things, and he took it in, and he found ways to spin it off in different directions and turn it all around and tell a very involving story. Now, it is very, very hard, George Lucas, to write a story about trade agreements that doesn't end up being... I mean, where it's hard to have the drama. Now, the reality is for if you're in that line of work, there's tons of drama.
Oh yeah, because there's people.
And there's negotiations on, and some of that stuff can be really, really high stakes and all this different stuff. However you feel about the five-party international thing with Iran negotiating for the nuclear thing, can you imagine being inside that room? Oh, I mean, the back and forth. And
can you imagine being inside that room after the defection?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you got to. I mean, hopefully somebody was taking notes to write a novel or a history book later, so that we can get some of that stuff. Because I mean, that's got to be just really amazing. Just the back and forth, because some of it's going to be just incredibly dry. Some of it's going to be like so tense and just like ooh.
I had an idea once, and I'm still looking at trying to do this. I had an idea for a book that involved the CIA and cloning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go any further than that, but
perhaps you've said too much.
I probably have already, given what they did to Tom Clancy.
Yeah.
But I got to think about it. I was like, it might not be a bad idea for me to put this on another planet.
Well,
because the world building would be easier, and I don't have to get everything right. Because if you're doing a story that's set in modern time or slightly toward the future time, part of what makes your story good is making sure that you've got your facts right, making sure that your world building is at least believable enough. You have enough of a sprinkling of fact and truthoids in it that the story part of what you're selling works.
Oh, yeah, because if your context, you may have a fantastic story.
Yeah, but if there's great one little thing, but if it blows the suspension of disbelief, then the whole thing doesn't work.
There was a trend probably 10, 15 years, no longer than that, maybe 20 years ago, for religious thrillers. This is pre-Dan Brown, okay? This was a post-Passover plot. I just dated myself there, which is a 1970s book about Jesus surviving the cross and blah, blah, blah. Right. It's completely based on a French guy who was revealed as being a liar. It's awesome. It's a great. If you ever want to go down that fun route of researching that story, it's a very entertaining example of two authors who were told something and wrote this very entertaining book, and it turned out the whole thing was based on nonsense. But anyway, it kind of kicked off a series of religious thrillers. Right, that these things would pop up, and it'd be like someone going, "Okay, this is the guy who's become the new pope, and he's secretly the Antichrist, or he's secretly he's a clone of Jesus, and it's all going to go wrong." And it's just, I mean, it's a whole trend of this stuff, right? I was a book dealer in those days. And so this stuff came across, and I'd pick it up and I'd read it. And I'm not Catholic, and I've never been to Rome, and I've never been inside the Vatican. But boy, a lot of those books just felt wrong. They just, I mean, they felt like somebody who had never been in those places either. And I think that's sometimes so it's when
I'm going to write this story based on what this person told this person told this person told me.
And for all I know, they had been inside the Vatican. For all I know, they'd been inside Rome. For all I know, they had had that depth of knowledge. But it didn't read that way to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that when what we have an advantage in the genre world is that you can tell a story. And Star Trek did this a lot. And this is kind of the original series. This was, you know, Gene Roddenberry did this all the time. Is you would take the story that's now, and you'd pick it up, and you'd drop it over on another planet.
And paint it with a science fiction brush.
Exactly. And you could tell those stories that the network was never going to let you get away with. You could never get the interracial kiss between Kirk and Uhura outside of the science fiction context in those days.
Right. If you did that in the FBI, it'd never go.
No, but science fiction. You know, you could have the two, and it wasn't a particularly great episode. Although there were moments. Let that be your last battlefield.
Yeah.
Okay. The concept behind it's actually really good. The execution of having the right,
that one was probably the most blatant out of the entire 79 episodes. I think.
Oh, sure. But at the same time, you look at you kind of wonder what that would have looked like if you'd had a better makeup design and a better, I mean, you had, you know, so anyway, but you were able to sit there and look at this stuff and, you know, yeah, it's grabbing hold of you. And that's one of those episodes that grabs hold of you by the collar and goes, racism is bad. And you're like,
we have a message.
Yeah.
Yes.
And racism is bad. And
it is.
And I think that, so, you know, was it heavy handed? Yes. And that's and here's an we can use Star Trek as a couple of good examples here. You have that one. You have the Nazi episode. What was the name of the Nazi episode?
That one was called Patterns of Force.
Thank you. But the biggest the one that I can't it's so hard for me to watch it ever. The Omega Glory.
Oh,
that's the one. That's the one where the Yangs.
Oh yeah,
and the Combs. And it's like wow.
E plebnista.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's like, hi there. I've brought a mallet on it. I've written the word moral.
Well,
and
I see, the one thing that bothers me about that particular episode is the presence of not the Yangs and the Combs so much, but the presence of a United States flag and a copy of the Constitution.
Right.
Which tells me, and the only way that you can do this is if you project on the episode that this is an Earth colony, that somehow nobody knows is an Earth colony.
Well, in the context of the story, you don't get that information, and in the context of the story, it doesn't make any sense. So right. That's bad storytelling. Now you look at Space Seed, which of course is the Ricardo Montalban, and
that hurt.
Yeah, don't do that again. That's a discussion. I mean, so much is happening in that episode. There's a couple of flaws.
MacGyver's.
Yes, that's right.
The other woman.
You know, and this is a flaw of so much television in general and during that time period. I've just met you. Now I'm in love with you.
Oh, yeah.
But other than that, and that happens a lot in Star Trek. That's how James T. Kirk got laid all the time.
But that wasn't falling in love.
Oh, but
that
many
was
of,
just,
but
that
many
was
of
just
them,
Jim Kirk
but
just
many of them
making
did.
Them swoon. They were
they,
just swooning.
They all fell in love with Kirk. And he fell in love a couple of three times anyway. But there's so much going on in that episode. And a lot of it is in things that you don't get details on. You just get enough. Yeah. You get enough context. The Eugenics Wars. Did we get 10 minutes of this was the Eugenics Wars?
We would have in the 90s.
Oh yeah, and then I think we could have. And I think that one of the things
it was that, called Mutinex.
Oh god. Oh, we got it, but when Deep Space Nine came along, and you know, we had enough context of the augments coming out of the Eugenics Wars that you didn't need. You could have a whole episode about Julian Bashir being, you know, genetically engineered. Spoiler, I guess. If you haven't watched, now you know. But you had that. If you were a Star Trek fan, they gave you enough. They didn't. You know, and you could have a whole episode where they talk about it. Mm-hmm. But there was a context to build on. You could sit there and go, and that's why everyone sat there and went, "Oh, you're one of them," because everyone was like, "Remember that Khan fellow? How did that? Yeah. How well did that work out?" So you had this kind of story, and then you had other, you know, City on the Edge of Forever.
Yeah.
Even for all the facts that it's not the story that was set out to be told, it's still an amazing Star Trek episode, and it's a very clear, powerful story. There are advantages, I think, in some ways, to doing a television script. And we talk about this in independent film a lot. It's shorter is often better.
Right.
It's like, you know, don't bore me.
Speaking of shorter.
Are you? What do you say?
We've got 40 minutes.
Oh wow! Okay,
we haven't taken a break yet.
Well, we should take a break because
this
we have sponsors.
We do have sponsor. A sponsor. We have a sponsor. Sponsor. It would be nice to have
the
more
sponsor.
The only one that we've got.
We like them though. They're a good sponsor. They're
superherostuff.com. They are purveyors of fine licensed merchandise, and we do encourage you to go visit their website and see all of the stuffs and things that they have. We are going to take a break here real quick, refill coffee mugs, and then we will come back probably with another longer segment. See, this is what happens. When we record on the same night as Level 117,
where
our episodes
run.
Are shorter.
Yeah.
And tonight, we don't have that, and there's we could be here all night.
We're not going to be here all night.
It could be a supersized episode. All right, we will be back right after this. Stand by.
You're listening to H2O on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Okay, Tom, try it now.
Superherostuff.com.
One more time.
Superherostuff.com.
Well, we want them to visit superherostuff.com, so maybe a little bigger.
Superherostuff.com.
There we go. That really gets in your head, doesn't it? Hi, this is Jason Hunt, and if you're one of the dedicated listeners for this show, first of all, thank you. Second, you are sharing with others, are you not? And you should be aware by now, we have many shows as part of Sci-Fi for Me Radio. Our Marvel discussion on Level 117, the DC chat on the Rogues Gallery, Sci-Fi for Chicks talking about various topics, which we also do in mixed company on the Echo Chamber, and H2O, which is our one-on-one discussion between Mr. Harvey and myself, now syndicated over at Amazing Stories Magazine. Sci-Fi for Me Radio is more than one show, and we'd like to invite you to join us for all of it, or at least try it out and see what you think. And also check out Sci-Fi for Me TV. That's our YouTube channel where we have interviews, convention panel video, and Week in Review, where we deliver a digest of the news of the week. All part of giving you the most bang for your buck. Oh yeah, wait, no, it's free. So check it out. Sci-Fi for Me Radio and Sci-Fi for Me TV. All part of SciFiForMe.com, your portal to the science fiction multiverse.
Our transmitters are made from hand-wavium. This is Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
There's room for another set of awards. Even if, you know, even if this whole thing with the Hugos is completely resolved and everyone walks away going, okay, fine, which isn't going to happen. But in case everyone sits there and goes, all right, we all agree to disagree, let's have coffee.
Oh, best coffee.
Best coffee.
We'll have that as a category.
Best use of coffee.
Yes. Well, it's, Twin Peaks.
If it comes back.
If it comes back, yes. David Lynch has left the building
unless unless Showtime turns around. I mean, I suspect he's not doing it as a negotiating tactic because he doesn't have to. But at the same time,
but see, if it wasn't,
it could be a negotiating tactic.
If it's not a negotiating tactic, he's leaving over money. Then that clearly says that David Lynch doesn't care about the story enough.
Which is why that, I think it's
which actually ties into what we're talking about because you know at what point does story get trumped by whatever else, you know, other considerations.
Hey, let's come back. I got an idea.
We are.
I know. Are we back already?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you schmuck. well, actually, Savannah's article today on Daredevil.
Yes, about Daredevil.
Okay,
yes.
All right. So go to our, actually, it's today on Monday, but it's already out. You should already have read it by now.
Right. Monday's article, Savannah Rogers, who's new to our site.
Yeah.
She started helping us with Planet Comic Con and video stuff, and she is going to cover the new Daredevil.
Right.
And in order to give us a little context, she's got an article out there on the 2003, the movie, the Ben Affleck movie Daredevil,
right,
and what actually went wrong.
Right.
And it wasn't Ben Affleck.
No, and I think that the argument could be very much made that the director's cut, and I actually was talking to Mitch Bryan not too long ago about the director's cut of Daredevil. Actually, it was at...
For those of you who don't know, Mitch Bryan wrote the first episode of the animated Batman.
It was at Comic-Con.
Yep.
We were talking about this. And so, yeah, the director's cut of the Ben Affleck Daredevil is not a bad movie. Is it? Would it have been? Were we ready yet for the explosion of comic book movies that we've gotten now? Probably not. Mm. Some of this stuff seems to happen. I mean, we almost lost it all with Batman and Robin. That almost killed it all right there, right?
Yeah.
Just like Superman Quest for Peace, more or less killed the superhero genre back in its day.
For a few years.
For a few years, yeah. And so I think that. And see, that's it. Bad story can do you in if you're in a niche.
And that's one of the things that Kendall was talking about. We were talking on the last Rogues Gallery.
Right.
And we were all making predictions on how long superhero stories were going to last.
Yeah.
And Kendall gave it another 4 years before it started to peter out. And the stories would start to suffer and then the audience would go away and then there's no money in it.
Well, because, I mean, there's a dangerous thing that happens when you get into the big studio system and not to criticize the business model of the studio system because it is what it is, right?
Oh, sure. Go ahead. Criticize.
I've done it a few times before. We have here, but the reality is that Hollywood is a money making enterprise.
Wait, okay? What?
It's true. Hollywood's first concern is not story.
You mean that $1 billion? That just happened to show up. That actually matters.
Yeah. Well, did you see the numbers of the Fast and Furious 7?
Yeah, broke April records,
and the one before that was Winter Soldier. So let's put this in context for you folks out there in our listening audience.
Well, 20th Century Fox just broke $1 billion.
Yeah. So I mean, I think you've got this, and I hear actually good things about Fast and Furious 7.
Mm-hmm. And if
it's the kind of film you like, you're going to really enjoy it. And there's a level of fun to those films, and they're popcorn movies.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with popcorn
Although,
movies.
Although, to hear Vin Diesel's talking about this one, this particular one, especially out of all the seven of them, mm-hmm. has more depth in the story than the rest of them.
Well, I think that you...
Because he's talking about Best Picture. He wants it to get a Best Picture nod.
Well, I think...
You know that's not going to happen.
I know. I wouldn't think it will. But there's something... Yeah, there's and that's a whole another episode for us where we can talk about the films, the genre films that should have been nominated for awards and weren't. Because
the Academy's a bunch of haters.
Well, because the Academy, I think the Academy still continues to have, and we've talked about this before. There's the idea that somehow that genre stuff isn't serious.
Well, and that's part of what's going on with the Hugo stuff now is, you know, because is it Torgerson who mm-hmm. was saying this idea of the distinction that the Hugo people are making between literary science fiction and entertaining science fiction. That actually sells.
And personally, I think that is a completely and utterly flawed argument. But it's the same. It's the same flaw that the Academy has. They're painting a distinction that doesn't exist, except in their minds.
I think that distinction does exist to a certain extent, and especially when it comes to the Academy stuff, because so many people have commented on it.
Oh well, yeah, no.
This blind
for the Academy.
Blind spot
Academy is, and again, I think, and part of it's history. Part of it is, you know, you didn't go to see, and this almost feels like blasphemy to say, you don't. And what an interesting thing to say in context of this. You didn't go to see Superman 2, where, you know, the first time on screen we got to watch Superman fight other Kryptonians.
Right.
And I still maintain has the best scene of every superhero film ever. Would you like to step outside?
Yep.
Although
the fight in Superman 3 in the junkyard comes a close second.
It's an excellent,
I like that one.
But you didn't go to that looking for depth per se.
Right.
You know, you weren't looking for great character development. You weren't looking for amazing social commentary or whatever. You know, the big issue things, which the Academy likes. The Academy likes to award. You know, we had a film about Alzheimer's this year with Julianne Moore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
right.
That's something that, you know, that affects a lot of people. Most of us know somebody now whose memory is starting. My grandmother had dementia, so you understand. You know, it's an important thing. The Academy likes important, you know, Selma. They like important stories.
Not that
they like important stories enough, because Selma only got one nomination.
That's the same thing they're talking about with the Hugo stuff. Is the things that have been getting nominated historically over the last few years, especially, have been the message stories.
Yeah, but the social.
We're in danger. We're swerving a little bit.
But at the same time, I don't think the argument holds weight over time. You look at the history of the Hugos and what's been nominated, and you've had years where it's skewed more entertainment, more pure entertainment value. You've had years where it's skewed more heavy literature.
Yeah.
But the thing is that
you also have to consider the context of society that we're in now. Being so divided politically, and, you know, the socio-political.
But if you're going to do that, you have to go back and look at every other historical context.
Maybe we should do that.
And I think maybe we could, because honestly, you look at stuff with Heinlein.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and actually, this is where I wanted to go. I wanted to go here anyway, so I'm actually going to bring us back around to this, folks. I promise. You look at Heinlein, and there was a Stranger in a Strange Land, or Starship Troopers, or The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. These books came out of the time they're in. All right, there's a reason that for a segment, and trust me, I met them and I almost was them, and managed to dodge it just a little bit. That whole thing that basically there were people who read Stranger in a Strange Land and thought, this is what life should be, And this is not me blasting them. This is me saying that as a guy who's almost 45, looking back at that now, I couldn't do that. I can't imagine building a life that way. But there are people who legitimately saw that the message of Stranger in a Strange Land was not a bad way to live a life.
Mm-hmm.
And that came out of a specific time, right? And I think there's a lot of things like that where those novels almost had to be written then. They couldn't be written any other time. Or they wouldn't have had the audience they had now. Because I think that so much of the story, even if it's not specifically a political story or a religious story or any of these things, a lot of it does come out of the time that it's written.
Right.
And that can be a good thing. That can be a good thing and a bad thing. But when it works, you end up with something that stands the test of time.
Like Moby Dick.
But that also brings the next thing is the flip side of that, which is some of these stories that are genre defying stories are a bitch to read.
Oh yeah.
But what makes them important is not that they are an easy read or even a particularly enjoyable read, is that they broke ground. So Moby Dick, for example, is not a fun book to read.
No.
Les Miserables.
I like Les Miserables.
Well, I like Les Miserables too, but did you read the full version or the version that's pretty much just the story and missing the 200 pages of political theory?
I probably read the former because that was in high school.
Yep, exactly.
And then I read The Count of Monte Cristo, which is essentially the exact same story.
In many ways.
A different author.
Yep. Well,
they're both French.
And a slightly different perspective, too. But it's classic revenge stories in many ways.
Yes.
The entire
setup is the exact same. You have an escaped convict.
Yeah, but one's on a revenge arc and one is on a redemption arc.
True.
I mean, but the thing is that.
But see, there's two different ways you could tell the same story.
Oh, sure.
A similar story.
Exactly. And I think that, some of these stories, for as much as I love Asimov, I totally get people who think his storytelling style is too dry.
Mm-hmm.
Asimov's big concern was not character. That was not his big focus.
Right.
His focus was on the science and on the story. He was telling a story that the characters were almost incidental to the bigger story he was telling.
Right.
And you can do that. So I think that, you know, for some of this stuff, yeah, it's the when they were written is critically important. And I think that once some of those folks got their foot in the door, people would come back and read their stuff. Bradbury. There's that dreamlike quality to Bradbury, a lot of his stuff, that I think that I don't know that he'd have the same impact now. Now, again, now is kind of a curious place to be, too, because we are awash, for good and for ill, in genre fiction right now. On one level, I have no complaints about that. On the other level, is it Sturgeon's Law?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Did you see, speaking of which, did you see the discussion? I ran across it on Tumblr. I'm actually starting to learn how to use that mess. Gail Simone.
Yeah.
Put this out there. She was at Emerald City, I think. Emerald City Comic Con, and she was talking to a colleague of hers who was talking about a phenomenon known as Tumblr fans.
Yes.
And Gail Simone was asking, is this a real thing? Is this a thing? She's like, I'm genuinely curious. I'm not trying to poke start anything. I'm really curious. Are these people real? Is there a certain segment of fandom who are fans of things because they see them on Tumblr, and it was almost as if you know the story of Star Wars by the GIFs you see on Tumblr.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, sure.
You've never seen the movie, but you see the little pieces, and so you're a fan.
Right.
Because of the pieces that you see.
Sure.
And it prompted an interesting discussion about how we have so much stuff to sift through now in terms of the content that gets generated online and in the bookstores and in the comic books. We've just so much, there's so much material, so many choices.
Oh, sure.
We're inundated with this now, almost to the point where there's too much. And we've talked about this before, that TED Talk, the guy talking about how we have too many choices now.
Sure.
Right. And it makes life miserable because we have too much choices. We immediately have buyer's remorse before we buy.
Right.
And I think in that context, you actually had people in the conversation saying, you know, I just don't have time to get to it all.
Right.
And Tumblr or Flickr or whatever other social media stuff is almost like a filter for some of these people to look at and say, that looks interesting. Now I'm going to go find it and read it or watch it or catch up to whatever else fandom knows. And I wonder if there's a, and I don't think, I mean, there's no way to put the genie back in the bottle.
No.
But does the quality of story suffer because we've got so much?
Well, I think that the answer is yes and no, because I think that because we have so many different ways of getting information, and again, Jason and I do this all the time. We date ourselves really, really well.
Because nobody else will date us.
Ba-dum-bum-ching. But it's sad, but true. Anyway.
It's better than dating each other.
So born in 1970, it would change the dynamic really, very much of this show. Because I think that people would be rather surprised. I was born in 1970. So bear in mind that the world that I grew up in until I was it 82 that cable really exploded? When was MTV? Was that 82, 83? Something like that, you know. So
yeah.
So you have to remember like that the first 10-12 years of my life was three channels, PBS if the weather was good. PBS was usually the weather was good. The PBS station was not that far from where we lived. I'd say that a lot, but we usually had a really good signal.
Yeah.
But you had you had 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock news, and you had the newspaper, and that's how you got your news. Okay, now we've got the 24-hour news cycle, and for good or for ill, especially for ill, because there's so much dross out there just to fill space, you know. And I certainly get that.
If it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah,
make it bleed.
Remember when CNN was new? Headline news.
Oh, yeah.
And we were just like, you can actually sit there and watch. You can watch an hour of news, and you sit there and go, I know what's happening in the world now.
Yeah.
And
especially after...
It was cutting edge. It was
especially
cutting edge
after Iraq.
Oh, yeah.
In 91.
Uh-huh.
When all of that happened. I mean, CNN basically made their bones right there.
Oh, yeah.
On Iraq. Because they were the only ones at the time.
And I think, unfortunately, you know, for once you end up with all these different places to get your news, you end up with commentary shows. You end up with TV personalities on every network. You just want to find a well and throw them down it.
But on both sides.
On every side. On every side. There's talking heads. Mm-hmm. Talking heads in the news world are
because you have to fill the time.
It's like color commentators in sports. And frankly, I have no use for any of these people. but the point, and I
unless
had one.
Unless it's Mystery Science Theater 3000.
That's a different thing entirely.
we should do some stuff like
we
that.
We should. We definitely should. But the thing is that how we got our information was much, much narrower. Now, the good news is that we have a reach now for the kind of information. I will argue long and convincingly about the benefit of knowing what's going on in the bigger world. I'm going to argue that very, very strongly that knowing what, you know, with the Ebola outbreak, okay, knowing that this stuff was happening, the turnaround time for all the fact that it was not fast enough to save more lives, the fact that that kind of thing, you know, you in the 70s and 80s, you might read a newspaper article about it, but it would be weeks before you knew what was really going on and what right. the level was. And now, I mean, you know, you can tell just by the way the world works now, there were probably a hell of a lot more lives saved now just by the fact that all of a sudden, you know, people knew about it. Now, at the same time, because there's so much happening, right, you get things like the Save Our Girls, the Boko Haram.
Yeah.
Okay, great, fantastic, wonderful. Everyone is like, you know, let's do something about it. Let's save the girls. And then the next thing came along, right? So unfortunately, you end up with an attention span issue because there's so much coming at you. And I think it comes back to too many choices, right?
Well, and the other thing too is in that context, you have so much stuff coming at you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know how much of it is true even.
Right. Well, yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's on the internet. It's all true.
Well, yes, of course. Everything on the internet is true.
Yes.
Well, and for example, you know, tie this right in. We have the Rolling Stone article that has, I mean, the report came out from the Columbia School of Journalism,
mm-hmm.
and it broke it all down, everything they did wrong. And one of the things that they, you know, and for some of it appears to be that some of it ended up being an emotional reaction to the story that they were hearing, the woman was telling. On one level, that's amazing and wonderful. You should have that kind of emotional reaction to a story like that.
Right.
But if you're a journalist,
yeah,
one of the critical things you have to do is multiple sources, and you've got to verify. And you know, you can't sit there and say.
And you have to stay objective.
And that's and I think that on one level, you and I swear to God, I'm going to bring this back to story in a minute. On one level, you have to you understand on a visceral level what it's like to have that, you know, as a person to react to that story and know that you can lose your objectivity. But then again, you end up with something like me calling you last night and saying I'm angry.
Yeah.
So, and why we're going to wait and because I need to put that anger aside or come back and stay angry, but be able to sit there and make my points without just being like, I'm angry.
Yes.
And I think that...
Well, the other thing, too, is you know, this affects, from a storytelling standpoint, you know, emotion does
factor write angry.
Into it.
Don't write angry.
Don't write angry, especially if you're a journalist, which, you know, in terms of the Hugo stuff, we're starting to see quite a bit of that.
Yeah.
And I don't have a problem with that as long as you mark it as an opinion piece.
Sure.
Which a lot of these people are not. Mm-hmm. I ran across the Entertainment Weekly article today,
mm-hmm.
which is just a hateful screed that is clearly an op-ed,
mm-hmm.
but it's not marked as such. Now, one of the things that I make sure that we do make a delineation. We do make a distinction.
Oh, sure.
Because we've got a completely different banner artwork, and mm-hmm. we mark the category opinion.
Right.
Or, you know, on the reviews and stuff. If it's news, it gets a certain particular
sure.
banner. This artwork, and it's mm-hmm. there is a distinction made between the news stories that we post and the opinion pieces we post.
Sure.
And that's something I think a lot of people, especially on the journalism side, are starting to forget.
Well, I think
there has to be a line between those two.
Difference. The I think one of the issues with the change in the media, and when I say media, I don't mean the media as in the media companies. I mean the media as in the transmission media.
Right.
Right. So
the channels by which you get your stuff.
Exactly. You know, the newspaper. You know, the newspaper was it for the longest time, you know, but you could still have and it was harder to catch the lies. Yellow journalism, you know, how many months had to go by before you realized, wait a minute,
yep,
that writer lied to me. Now you can be busted in a matter of weeks or days. Sometimes you can be caught in days. Remember when James Frye? What is it? A Million Little Pieces? Is that the book? James Frye, the author who wrote his autobiography, and it turned out that it was all just made up.
Sounds familiar.
I think it was a Million Little Pieces. Anyway, got busted. Oprah ripped him apart on her show, and it was a huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge deal because we want to trust that the autobiography is true. We want to trust that the news is true. We want to trust that the story is true.
Yeah.
But again, we come back to there's so much information out there that it's really easy. And especially when you get into, you know, the wonderful world of the blogger, and, you know, half the time those people are telling a different kind of story that doesn't seem to have a whole lot of basis in any kind of fact. It's an opinion piece without being marked an opinion piece. There's a thing that happened once the internet came into being is this is what really happened. Please cite your sources. This is what really happened.
Oh, yeah.
No. Seriously, I need you to cite your sources. I need some footnotes, and I require links to your data. And you don't get that a lot because a lot of these people are opinion pieces, but they're presenting them as fact.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it comes to fictional stories, I swear to God, I'm bringing this back around. see how we digress here, folks. You knew this already. If you listened to us, you know we go off on these tangents. The thing about
it's all of a piece, though.
Well, it is. I think in the larger sense, it is. When it comes to things like television storytelling, which I think is as much as Jason and I both have huge collections of books, and we talked a little bit. A lot of what people think of in genre storytelling anymore is your television and your film, right?
Right.
For the vaster audience, the bigger audience outside the regular genre fans, the people who discovered fantasy through Game of Thrones, people who have discovered comic books through the Avengers movies or Iron Man or the Incredible Hulk or whatever. Mm-hmm. You look at this stuff and you're expecting a certain kind of storytelling now. And this is when Intelligence was on last year. This is why this show completely crashed and burned, is because it was the types of stories they were telling. And this is a big concern about folks with the X-Files coming back. Because there was in the 90s, in the 80s and 90s, episodic television for this kind of stuff. Now, episodic television has been around for a long, long time. Dawn of television. And the only narratives, the only long-form narrative storytelling you were getting were soap operas. And sometimes they were daytime, nighttime soaps like Falcon Crest and Dynasty and all that stuff.
Right.
You know, Dallas. But most stuff, you know, if you had a science fiction show, Buck Rogers,
mm-hmm.
Was episodic. There was no through line. There was no, and this season's arc was.
Now, Battlestar Galactica kind of had a little bit of an arc.
It kind of did, but it was so broad and nebulous that you could come. But the thing is that you could come in on any episode of that, and you had your prologue. You had your. The ragtag fleet,
right?
You know, so
previously, yeah.
Exactly. And but the thing is that you didn't need to watch the episode before it. There was never any question of going, well, I'm completely lost with what's happening here. You might have a two-parter every now and again, but for the most part, it was, you know, tune in this week and it's the same thing as next week and
right.
or whatever. And then, of course, we that type of storytelling changed. We had things like Farscape and 24 and Lost. British television is a whole different. British storytelling is a whole different episode.
Right, but in the 80s,
yeah.
We got Doctor Who on PBS.
Oh, sure.
So we started to get some of that, serialized back
right.
then.
Right. Well, but it was in
blocks.
Right.
You know, 12
but,
episodes.
But for general episodes. American television, we weren't getting that. Now you can't. It is very, very hard. Now you can still do it with a sitcom.
Yeah.
You can still do it with some types of storytelling, but for the most part, if you have a legal drama on television, there's an arc. There's a bigger storytelling, you know. But yet, Murder One was groundbreaking at the time in that
right.
genre. Now, if you try and do a science fiction series where every episode is the reset, no one's going to watch it.
Right.
Because they're going to want character development, and that's a critical piece of story. See how I really am bringing this back around? Character development has to happen. Your characters have to grow.
Yeah.
It is almost impossible, and I'm not saying it can't be done, because I can. There's stuff out there. But you really can't have your character end up at the same place that they started the story. You could put them in the same situation they were in.
But the character has
to have to growth, and you have to have a chance. You have to have a chance to.
Unless you're doing something like that idea that you guys have had about the superpower family,
right?
That's something that you could do episodically. I mean, you could do an overall arc.
You would still have to have an overall arc. I think again because. It's if you don't build on it, and what we're basically talking about here, folks, is an idea we've got for a genre comedy that is set in the world of superheroes and supervillains and domestic life, or domestic bliss, more accurately.
I love Lucy with capes.
That's right. Yeah. Something along those lines.
Oh, isn't that a heck of a log line?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? That's how you'd pitch it in Hollywood.
That is.
And then you'd have the guy looking across from the thing looking for you and go, I love Lucy. What's that?
Yeah. Married with Children with capes.
There you go. Only better. And I liked Married with Children back in the day. But for all of this stuff, you have to have a way. If you're not connecting your character, your audience with your characters, I think you've lost them. I think and now you have to think about the various things that are especially in media entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to think about things that are if you're telling an episodic story, you can't just be telling it can't just have the reset every week. You've got to tell a bigger thing because you've got to get character growth.
Yeah.
And then you run into stuff with like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. during the first season where you could have chopped out 8 episodes of that show because all they were doing was spinning their wheels. And they were basically giving us something we didn't want, which was it's the power of the week episode. You know, it's the conflict of the week episode. And now that we have stuff like X-Files coming back in the 90s, you could have the Monster of the Week episode. Nobody does the Monster of the Week episode really anymore. I mean, Grimm does it to a point. Grimm does it to a point. But even then, Grimm is telling a larger story. You're telling, you got the whole thing with the royals and all that stuff. So I think that audiences want more. They want for storytelling now, especially. You've got to have a story that keeps them coming back for more.
Mm-hmm.
And audiences in when you had limited options. You know what? When you had 3 networks, you know there were only so many options you got.
Right.
And if science fiction wasn't selling, there was no science fiction on television. If Westerns weren't selling, there were no Westerns on television. Now, there was a lot of Westerns on television for a very long time. And some of them were really good. And there was science fiction on television every now and again. And some of it was awful. But as soon as cable exploded, you got the explosion of genre television. You had so much stuff coming up. For good and for ill. I mean, there's some really good stuff. But you end up with your audience for some of that cable was so small that you never had a chance to get some of that stuff survive. I'm telling you, I'm always going to miss Nowhere Man.
They'll reboot it.
Well, you know what? I keep thinking that they're going to one of these days, and they just don't. Because it's The Fugitive crossed with The Prisoner. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is genius. Oh, it's canceled. Never mind. People.
They'll reboot it.
People weren't ready for that kind of storytelling, and they weren't.
I mean, they're bringing back Coach. They're gonna reboot it. Nowhere Man.
Part of me, my on one hand, my mind is boggled by that.
We'll get another Starman. I mean, right after the Play-Doh movie, we'll get Starman.
Yes, and ladies and gentlemen, let me just go that the death of story may have occurred because we're getting a Play-Doh movie, and I don't understand how this works. The Lego movie, I am behind the Lego movie. And I'm pretty sure at some point I sat there and we're making a movie about Legos.
Did seriously? You see? Did you see and that the guys who are behind the Lego movie are being looked at for
the Flash film?
The Flash film.
I think it's a very interesting idea, and and I don't know. I think it's an interesting idea. I don't know how I feel about it,
because they did 21 Jump Street movie.
Right.
Reboot.
And I have to say, I kind of enjoyed, I haven't seen the second one. I kind of enjoyed the first one.
I haven't seen either one of them. I looked at it and I went, but that looks kind of stupid.
But I'll tell you what, and we've talked about this before too. Those people making that film understood where the humor should lie in rebooting, in doing a comedy version of a TV show, which we've seen before, you know, with Dukes of Hazzard and things like that, and Starsky and Hutch, and that sort of thing. But they understood where the humor lied.
See, and I don't see the point of making it making a comedy version if you're gonna tell that story. Why not just tell the story?
Well, because the thing is,
put it into the contemporary context or whatever, because and just tell the story.
Because at the core of the core of 21 Jump Street is the ludicrous concept.
That these 20-something, 30-something kids.
They recognize that. And they got a lot of the original cast to come back.
Yeah.
And treat it in a way where they, I mean, the people who wrote this clearly loved 21 Jump Street. And they but they also loved it in the way that you can recognize that it's got its flaws, but you love it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so they treated it like the beloved thing that needed to be poked a little, and it worked. And I think there is a way to do that. Now, some things don't survive that well, but some things do. And they found the right balance in terms of storytelling again, because they understood where the humor in the concept lie.
Right.
Whereas you look at something like Dukes of Hazzard. And Dukes of Hazzard kind of came out of a time when the South was a punchline. Honestly, on television and in entertainment,
right?
The South was kind of a punchline. So you could have a show with those stereotypes. That Dukes of Hazzard has a lot of stereotypes.
They do. But I don't. I think the movie does a lot more. The South as a punchline than the TV show did.
But the thing is,
the TV show did that, but
there's a context of the time, right? And so I think that whereas we looked at the world differently then, we looked at our entertainment differently then. Mm-hmm. You could get remember there was a time when people did not recognize that Archie Bunker was satire. Okay, there were people
people still don't.
I know there were people who got very very angry about how. Archie Bunker came across.
Yep.
And there are people who got very, very upset that there was a mayor being held up to them. And they failed to grasp the fact that Archie Bunker was satire. You were supposed to think that Archie Bunker was horrible, because Archie Bunker was horrible.
Yes, he was.
And there was a reason, and yet it was still a comedy. And so, you know, we looked at entertainment differently. We looked at storytelling differently on television then. We demand more of our stories now, which I think is good. We demand more depth. We demand more. You could not get on American television, you couldn't get House of Cards 10 years ago, no. 20 years ago, 30 years ago. There's no way. Now, House of Cards was the British series. Was it 15 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years? It's been a while. So the British are in many ways ahead of us for that kind of storytelling. But
you're also going to see, you know, you talk about Netflix shows and the arc and the depth. I have a feeling that Netflix, just the concept of the binge watching series, is going to change the paradigm again.
It already is because when like House of Cards, when the new season came out, it's like, here you go.
Yeah. You know,
but the model
well, and
is
Daredevil.
Oh yeah, Daredevil coming up. The model is changing anyway because Showtime rolled out, you know, was rolling out shows like True Detective or Penny Dreadful or some of these things where you're
the following.
You're
Fox.
Following where you're getting these. This is the story. It's this many episodes. Mm-hmm. And whether or not we get renewed, we're not worrying about that right now.
Right.
Because we've shot the whole story. And here you go. Which is, again, we talked about this before, too. It's a very British model where the season is only X number of episodes, and it might be six. Mm-hmm. You know, we do that. We do a longer series here, but I mean, it's still the idea that you can get. They're looking at telling a longer story, but they're also looking at telling a constrained story. And I think that's important too, because we've seen plenty of shows where to get to the point, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., you've got a lot of spinning wheel time. And I think that audiences aren't willing to accept that anymore.
Yeah.
They've got other things they can watch. They've got more choices. And so they don't have to sit there and go, well, I've only got three networks. I'll have to ride this out. Because I think in terms of storytelling, a great time to be a storyteller.
We need to be telling more stories.
Oh God, I know
we need to be doing some. We need to do some original stuff.
I know we do. We do. Yep. We do really do.
We'll put a pin in that.
Definitely one of our many pins.
Yeah, really. You should see my list of pins. All right, that's gonna wrap it up for us tonight, because we could talk about this.
Oh, we could
all night, all week. And we have other podcasts we can record the rest of the week. We do encourage you to support our sponsor, superherostuff.com, and go shop there early and often. And if you have a comment on what you think makes a good story, you'd like to leave that over on our site, scififorme.com, or you can send us an email, h2o@scififorme.com, and we're on the social media: Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Google+, Tumblr, Pinterest. And you can subscribe to these podcasts if you so desire. We are available on iTunes if you're on an Apple device. If you're running Android, we've got Double Twist, OneCast, and Stitcher, all the different apps through which you can find us. Just look for Sci-Fi for Me Radio, and you'll see all the different shows that we've got there. And that's going to do it for us. Well, we also have our TV channel.
We do.
YouTube.com/Sci-Fi for Me, which is Sci-Fi for Me TV.
Some great convention stuff up on there.
Yes. We just posted our panel with Ming-Na Wen, mm-hmm, from Planet Comic-Con. And we'll have other stuff posting there as well. We've got some other interviews still left to post, and interviews with the two Red Power Rangers and a couple of others. So that's coming, so be looking for that. And as always, we do invite you to share this with others that you think might be interested. I know we went a little bit long this time.
We do that
somebody
sometimes.
Looks at the running time on these things and goes, ah, it's got an hour and a half to list.
That's
this.
All right. That's all right. Have a break in the middle.
That's
ish,
right.
Ish, middle ish.
Yeah.
Somewhere around the middle.
And it kind of is in the middle still.
I know.
Yeah. So, all right. That's going to do it for us, Timothy Harvey.
Thank you.
I'm Jason Hunt. And for everyone here at Sci-Fi for Me, thanks very much for joining us, and we will be back next week.
This has been a presentation of SciFiForMe.com. Copyright 2015 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. This is Sci-Fi for Me Radio.